thing, not just notice it as he used to notice things in the city. He would see all parts of it, see the whole wing, the feathers, see the color of the feathers, see the bush and the size and shape and color of its leaves. He would see the way the light moved with the ripples on the water, and see that the wind made the ripples and which way that wind had to blow to make the ripples move in that certain way. None of that used to be in Brian, and now it was a part of him, a changed part of him, a grown part of him, and the two things, his mind and his body, had come together as well, had made a connection with each other that he didn't quite understand. When his ears heard a sound or his eyes saw a sight, his mind took control of his body. Without his thinking, he moved to face the sound or sight, moved to make ready for it, to deal with it. There were these things to do. When the wood was done, he decided to get a signal fire ready. He moved to the top of the rock ridge that comprised the bluff over his shelter and was pleased to find a large, flat stone area. More wood, he thought, moaning inwardly. He went back to the fallen trees and found more dead limbs, carrying them up on the rock until he had enough for a bonfire. Initially, he had thought of making a signal fire every day, but he couldn't. He would never be able to keep the wood supply going. So while he was working, he decided to have the fire ready, and if he heard an engine or even thought he heard a plane engine, he would run up with a burning limb and set off the signal fire. Things to do. At the last trip to the top of the stone bluff with wood, he stopped, sat on the point overlooking the lake, and rested. The lake lay before him, 20 or so feet below, and he had not seen it this way since he had come in with the plane. Remembering the crash, he had a moment of fear, a breath-tightening little rip of terror, but it passed and he was quickly caught up in the beauty of the scenery. It was so incredibly beautiful that it was almost unreal. From his height he could see not just the lake but across part of the forest, a green carpet, and it was full of life. Birds, insects, there was a constant hum and song. At the other end of the bottom of the L there was another large rock sticking out over the water, and on top of the rock a snaggly pine had somehow found food and grown, bent and gnarled. Sitting on one limb was a blue bird with a crest and sharp beak, a kingfisher. He thought of a picture he had seen once, which left the branch while he watched and dove into the water. It emerged a split part of a second later. In its mouth was a small fish, wiggling silver in the sun. It took the fish to a limb, juggled it twice, and swallowed it whole. Fish. Of course, he thought, there were fish in the lake, and they were food, and if a bird could do it... He scrambled down the side of the bluff and trotted to the edge of the lake, looking down into the water. Somehow it had never occurred to him to look inside the water, only at the surface. The sun was flashing back up into his eyes, and he moved off to the side and took off his shoes and waded out 15 feet. Then he turned and stood still with the sun at his back and studied the water again. It was, he saw after a moment, literally packed with life. Small fish swam everywhere. Some narrow and long, some round, most of them 3 or 4 inches long, some a bit larger, and many smaller. There was a patch of mud off to the side leading into deeper water, and he could see old clam shells there, so there must be clams. As he watched, a crayfish looking like a tiny lobster left one of the empty clam shells and went to another, looking for something to eat, digging with its claws. While he stood, some of the small, roundish fish came quite close to his legs, and he tensed, got ready, and made a wild stab at grabbing one of them. They exploded away in 100 flicks of quick light so fast that he had no hope of catching them that way. But they soon came back, seemed to be curious about him, and as he walked from the water, he tried to think of a way to use that curiosity to catch them. He had no hooks or string, but if he could somehow lure them into the shallows and make a spear... A small fish spear, he might be able to strike fast enough to get one. He would have to find the right kind of wood, slim and straight. He had seen some willows up along the lake that might work, and he could use the hatchet to sharpen it and shape it while he was sitting by the fire tonight. And that brought up the fire, which he had to feed again. He looked at the sun and saw it was getting late in the afternoon, and when he thought of how late it was, he thought that he ought to reward all his work with another egg, and that made him think that some kind of dessert would be nice. He smiled when he thought of dessert. So fancy. And he wondered if he should move up the lake and see if he could find some raspberries after he banked the fire and while he was looking for the right wood for a spear. Spearwood, he thought. And it all rolled together. Just rolled together and rolled over him. there were these things to do. The fish spear didn't work. He stood in the shallows and waited again and again. The small fish came closer and closer, and he lunged time after time, but was always too slow. He tried throwing it, jabbing it, everything but flailing with it, and it didn't work. The fish were just too fast. He had been so sure, so absolutely certain that it would work the night before. Sitting by the fire, he had taken the willow and carefully peeled the bark until he had a straight staff about 6 feet long and just under an inch thick at the base, the thickest end. Then, propping the hatchet in a crack in the rock wall, he had pulled the head of his spear against it, carving a thin piece off each time, until the thick end tapered down to a needle point. Still not satisfied, he could not imagine hitting one of the fish with a single point. He carefully used the hatchet to split the point up the middle for 8 or 10 inches, and jammed a piece of wood up into the split to make a two-pronged spear with the points about 2 inches apart. It was crude, but it looked effective and seemed to have good balance when he stood outside the shelter and hefted the spear. He had worked on the fish spear until it had become more than just a tool. He'd spent hours and hours on it, and now it didn't work. He moved into the shallows and stood, and the fish came to him. Just as before, they swarmed around his legs, some of them almost 6 inches long, but no matter how he tried, they were too fast. At first he tried throwing it, but that had no chance. As soon as he brought his arm back, well before he threw, the movement frightened them. Next he tried lunging at them, having the spear ready just above the water and thrusting with it. Finally he actually put the spear in the water and waited until the fish were right in front of it, but still somehow he telegraphed his motion before he thrust, and they saw it and flashed away. He needed something to spring the spear forward, some way to make it move faster than the fish, some motive force, a string that snapped, or a bow and arrow, a thin, long arrow with the point in the water and the bow pulled back so that all he had to do was release the arrow. Yes, that was it. He had to invent the bow and arrow. He almost laughed as he moved out of the water and put his shoes on. The morning sun was getting hot, and he took his shirt off. Maybe that was how it really happened, way back when. Some primitive man tried to spear fish, and it didn't work, and he invented the bow and arrow. Maybe it was always that way. Discoveries happened because they needed to happen. He had not eaten anything yet this morning, so he took a moment to dig up the eggs and eat one. Then he reburied them, banked the fire with a couple of thicker pieces of wood, settled the hatchet on his belt, and took the spear in his right hand and set off up the lake to find wood to make a bow. He went without a shirt, but something about the wood smoke smell on him kept the insects from bothering him as he walked to the berry patch. The raspberries were starting to become overripe. Just in 2 days, and he would have to pick as many as possible after he found the wood, but he did take a little time now to pick a few and eat them. They were full and sweet, and when he picked one, two others would fall off the limbs into the grass, and soon his hands and cheeks were covered with red berry juice, and he was full. That surprised him, being full. He hadn't thought he would ever be full again, knew only the hunger, and here he was, full. One turtle egg and a few handfuls of berries, and he felt full. He looked down at his stomach and saw that it was still caved in, did not bulge out as it would have with 2 hamburgers and a freezy slush. It must have shrunk, and there was still hunger there, but not like it was, not tearing at him. This was hunger that he knew would be there always, even when he had food. A hunger that made him look for things, see things. A hunger to make him hunt. He swung his eyes across the berries to make sure the bear wasn't there, at his back. Then he moved down to the lake. The spear went out before him automatically, moving the brush away from his face as he walked. And when he came to the water's edge, he swung left, not sure what he was looking for, not knowing what wood might be best for a bow. He had never made a bow, never shot a bow in his life. But it seemed that it would be along the lake, near the water. He saw some young birch, and they were springy, but they lacked snap somehow, as did the willows, not enough whip back. Halfway up the lake, just as he started to step over a log, he was absolutely terrified by an explosion under his feet. Something like a feathered bomb blew up and away in a flurry of leaves and thunder. It frightened him so badly that he fell back and down, and then it was gone, leaving only an image in his mind. A bird it had been, about the size of a very small chicken, only with a fan tail and stubby wings that slammed against its body and made loud noise. Noise, there and gone. He got up and brushed himself off. The bird had been speckled, brown and gray, and it must not be very smart because Brian's foot had been nearly on it before it flew. Half a second more and he would have stepped on it. And caught it, he thought, and eaten it. He might be able to catch one, or spear one. Maybe, he thought, maybe it tasted like chicken. Maybe he could catch one or spear one, and it probably did taste just like chicken. Just like chicken when his mother baked it in the oven with garlic and salt, and it turned golden brown and crackled. He shook his head to drive the picture out and moved down to the shore. There was a tree there with long branches that seemed straight, and when he pulled on one of them and let it go, it had an almost vicious snap to it. He picked one of the limbs that seemed right and began chopping where the limb joined the tree. The wood was hard, and he didn't want to cause it to split, so he took his time, took small chips and concentrated so hard that at first he didn't hear it. A persistent whine, like the insects, only more steady with an edge of a roar to it, was in his ears, and he chopped and cut and was thinking of a bow, how he would make a bow, how it would be when he shaped it with the hatchet, and still the sound did not cut through until the limb was nearly off the tree and the whine was inside his head, and he knew it then. A plane. It was a motor, far off but seeming to get louder. They were coming for him. He threw down the limb and his spear, and holding the hatchet, he started to run for camp. He had to get fire up on the bluff and signal them, get fire and smoke up. He put all of his life into his legs, jumped logs and moved through brush like a light ghost, swiveling and running, his lungs filling and blowing, and now the sound was louder, coming in his direction. If not right at him, at least closer. He could see it all in his mind now, the picture, the way it would be. He would get the fire going and the plane would see the smoke and circle, circle once, then again, and waggle its wings. It would be a float plane and it would land on the water and come across the lake, and the pilot would be amazed that he was alive after all these days. All this he saw as he ran for the camp and the fire. They would take him from here, and this night, this very night, he would sit with his father and eat and tell him all the things. He could see it now, oh yes, all, as he ran in the sun, his legs liquid springs. He got to the camp, still hearing the whine of the engine, and one stick of wood still had good flame. He dove inside and grabbed the wood and ran around the edge of the ridge, scrambled up like a cat, and blew and nearly had the flame feeding, growing, when the sound moved away. It was abrupt. As if the plane had turned. He shielded the sun from his eyes and tried to see it, tried to make the plane become real in his eyes, but the trees were so high, so thick, and now the sound was still fainter. He kneeled again to the flames and blew and added grass and chips, and the flames fed and grew, and in moments he had a bonfire as high as his head. But the sound was gone now. Look back, he thought. Look back and see the smoke now and turn. Please turn. Look back, he whispered, feeling all the pictures fade, seeing his father's face fade like the sound, like lost dreams, like an end to hope. Oh, turn now and come back. Look back and see the smoke and turn for me. But it kept moving away until he could not hear it, even in his imagination, in his soul. Gone. He stood on the bluff over the lake, his face cooking in the roaring bonfire, watching the clouds of ash and smoke going into the sky, and thought, no, more than thought, he knew then that he would not get out of this place. Not now, not ever. That had been a search plane, he was sure of it. That must have been them, and they had come as far off to the side of the flight plan as they thought they would have to come, and then turned back. They did not see his smoke, did not hear the cry from his mind. They would not return. He would never leave now, never get out of here. He went down to his knees and felt the tears start, cutting through the smoke and ash on his face, silently falling onto the stone. Gone, he thought finally. It was all gone, all silly and gone. No bows, no spears or fish or berries. It was all silly anyway, all just a game. He could do a day, but not forever. He could not make it if they did not come for him someday. He could not play the game without hope, could not play the game without a dream. They had taken it all away from him now. They had turned away from him, and there was nothing for him now. The plane gone, his family gone, all of it gone. They would not come. He was alone, and there was nothing for him. Brian stood at the end of the long part of the L of the lake and watched the water, smelled the water, listened to the water, was the water. A fish moved and his eyes jerked sideways to see the ripples, but he did not move any other part of his body and did not raise the bow or reach into his belt pouch for a fish arrow. It was not the right kind of fish, not a food fish. The food fish stayed close in the shallows, and did not roll that way, but made quicker movements, small movements, food movements. The large fish rolled and stayed deep and could not be taken. But it didn't matter. This day, this morning, he was not looking for fish. Fish was light meat, and he was sick of them. He was looking for one of the foolish birds. He called them fool birds, and there was a flock that lived near the end of the long part of the lake. But something he did not understand had stopped him, and he stood, breathing gently through his mouth to keep silent, letting his eyes and ears go out and do the work for him. It had happened before this way. Something had come into him from outside to warn him, and he had stopped. Once it had been the bear again. He had been taking the last of the raspberries, and something came inside and stopped him. And when he looked where his ears said to look, there was a female bear with cubs. Had he taken two more steps, he would have come between the mother and her cubs, and that was a bad place to be. As it was, the mother had stood and faced him and made a sound, a low sound in her throat, to threaten and warn him. He paid attention to the feeling now, and he stood and waited, patiently, knowing he was right and that something would come. Turn, smell, listen, feel, and then a sound, a small sound. And he looked up and away from the lake and saw the wolf. It was halfway up the hill from the lake, standing with its head and shoulders sticking out into a small opening, looking down on him with wide yellow eyes. He had never seen a wolf, and the size threw him. Not as big as a bear, but somehow seeming that large. The wolf claimed all that was below him as his own, took Brian as his own. Brian looked back and for a moment felt afraid because the wolf was so right. He knew the wolf now, as the wolf knew him, and he nodded to it, nodded and smiled. The wolf watched him for another time, another part of his life, then it turned and walked effortlessly up the hill, and as it came out of the brush it was followed by three other wolves, all equally large and gray and beautiful, all looking down on him as they trotted past and away, and Brian nodded to each of them. He was not the same now. The Brian that stood and watched the wolves move away and nodded to them was completely changed. Time had come, time that he measured but didn't care about. Time had come into his life and moved out and left him different. In measured time, 47 days had passed since the crash. 42 days, he thought, since he had died and been born as the new Brian. When the plane had come and gone, it had put him down, gutted him and dropped him and left him with nothing. The rest of that first day he had gone down and down until dark. He had let the fire go out, had forgotten to eat even an egg, had let his brain take him down to where he was done, where he wanted to be done and done, to where he wanted to die. He had settled into the gray funk deeper and still deeper until finally, in the dark, he had gone up on the ridge and taken the hatchet and tried to end it by cutting himself. Madness. A hissing madness that took his brain. There had been nothing for him then, and he tried to become nothing. But the cutting had been hard to do, impossible to do, and he had at last fallen to his side, wishing for death, wishing for an end, and slept, only didn't sleep. With his eyes closed and his mind open, he lay on the rock through the night, lay and hated and wished for it to end, and thought the word, cloud down, through that awful night. Over and over the word, wanting all his clouds to come down. But in the morning he was still there. Still there, on his side, and the sun came up, and when he opened his eyes, he saw the cuts on his arm, the dry blood turning black. He saw the blood and hated the blood, hated what he had done to himself when he was the old Brian and was weak, and two things came into his mind, two true things. He was not the same. The plane passing changed him. The disappointment cut him down and made him new. He was not the same and would never be again like he had been. That was one of the true things, the new things. And the other one was that he would not die. He would not let death in again. He was new. Of course, he had made a lot of mistakes. He smiled now, walking up the lake shore after the wolves were gone, thinking of the early mistakes. The mistakes that came before he realized that he had to find new ways to be what he had become. He had made new fire, which he now kept going using partially rotten wood because the punky wood would smolder for many hours and still come back with fire. But that had been the extent of doing things right for a while. His first bow was a disaster that almost blinded him. He had sat a whole night and shaped the limbs carefully until the bow looked beautiful. Then he had spent 2 days making arrows. The shafts were willow, straight and with the bark peeled, and he fire-hardened the points and split a couple of them to make forked points, as he had done with the spear. He had no feathers, so he just left them bare, figuring for fish they only had to travel a few inches. He had no string, and that threw him until he looked down at his tennis shoes. They had long laces, too long, and he found that one lace cut in half would take care of both shoes, and that left the other lace for a bowstring. All seemed to be going well until he tried a test shot. He put an arrow to the string, pulled it back to his cheek, pointed it at a dirt hummock, and at that precise instant the bow wood exploded in his hand, sending splinters and chips of wood into his face. Two pieces actually stuck into his forehead, just above his eyes, and had they been only slightly lower, they would have blinded him. Too stiff. Mistakes. In his mental journal he listed them to tell his father, listed all the mistakes. He had made a new bow, with slender limbs and a more fluid, gentle pull, but could not hit the fish, though he sat in the water and was in the end surrounded by a virtual cloud of small fish. It was infuriating. He would pull the bow back, set the arrow just above the water, and when the fish was no more than an inch away, release the arrow, only to miss. It seemed to him that the arrow had gone right through the fish again and again, but the fish didn't get hurt. Finally, after hours, he stuck the arrow down in the water, pulled the bow, and waited for a fish to come close. And while he was waiting, he noticed that the water seemed to make the arrow bend or break in the middle. Of course, he had forgotten that water refracts, bends light. He had learned that somewhere in some class. Maybe it was biology. He couldn't remember. But it did bend light, and that meant the fish were not where they appeared to be. They were lower, just below, which meant he had to aim just under them. He would not forget his first hit, not ever. A round-shaped fish with golden sides, sides as gold as the sun, stopped in front of the arrow, and he aimed just beneath it, at the bottom edge of the fish, and released the arrow, and there was a bright flurry, a splash of gold in the water. He grabbed the arrow and raised it up, and the fish was on the end, wiggling against the blue sky. He held the fish against the sky until it stopped wiggling, held it and looked to the sky and felt his throat tighten, swell, and fill with pride at what he had done. He had done food. With his bow, with an arrow fashioned by his own hands, he had done food, had found a way to live. The bow had given him this way, and he exulted in it, in the bow, in the arrow, in the fish, in the hatchet, in the sky. He stood and walked from the water, still holding the fish and arrow and bow against the sky, seeing them as they fit his arms, as they were part of him. He had food. He cut a green willow fork and held the fish over the fire until the skin crackled and peeled away, and the meat inside was flaky and moist and tender. This he picked off carefully with his fingers, tasting every piece, mashing them in his mouth with his tongue to get the juices out of them, hot, steaming pieces of fish. He could not, he thought then, ever get enough. And all that first day, first new day, he spent going to the lake, shooting a fish, taking it back to the fire, cooking it and eating it, then back to the lake, shooting a fish, cooking it and eating it, and on that way until it was dark. He had taken the scraps back to the water with the thought they might work for bait, and the other fish came by the hundreds to clean them up. He could take his pick of them. Like a store, he thought, just like a store, and he could not remember later how many he ate that day, but he thought it must have been over 20. It had been a feast day. his first feast day, and a celebration of being alive, and the new way he had of getting food. By the end of that day, when it became dark, and he lay next to the fire with his stomach full of fish, and grease from the meat smeared around his mouth, he could feel new hope building in him. Not hope that he would be rescued, that was gone, but hope in his knowledge. Hope in the fact that he could learn and survive and take care of himself. Tough hope, he thought that night. I am full of tough hope. Mistakes. Small mistakes could turn into disasters. Funny little mistakes could snowball so that while you were still smiling at the humor, you could find yourself looking at death. In the city, if you made a mistake, usually there was a way to rectify it, make it all right. If he fell on his bike and sprained a leg, he could wait for it to heal. If he forgot something at the store, he could find other food in the refrigerator. Now it was different and all so quick, all so incredibly quick. If he sprained a leg here, he might starve before he could get around again. If he missed while he was hunting, or if the fish moved away, he might starve. If he got sick, really sick, so he couldn't move, he might starve. Mistakes. Early in the new time, he had learned the most important thing, the truly vital knowledge that drives all creatures in the forest. Food is all. Food was simply everything. All things in the woods, from insects to fish to bears, were always, always looking for food. It was the great single driving influence in nature, to eat. All must eat. But the way he learned it almost killed him. His second new night, stomach full of fish and the fire smoldering in the shelter, he had been sound asleep when something, he thought later it might be smell, had awakened him. Near the fire, completely unafraid of the smoking coals, completely unafraid of Brian, a skunk was digging where he had buried the eggs. There was some sliver of a moon, and in the faint pearl light he could see the bushy tail, the white stripes down the back, and he had nearly smiled. He did not know how the skunk had found the eggs. Some smell, perhaps some tiny fragment of shell, had left the smell, but it looked almost cute, its little head down, its little tail up, as it dug and dug, kicking the sand back. But those were his eggs, not the skunk's, and the half-smile had been quickly replaced with fear that he would lose his food, and he had grabbed a handful of sand and thrown it at the skunk. "Get out of here!" He was going to say more, some silly human words, but in less than half a second, the skunk had snapped its rear end up, curved the tail over, and sprayed Brian with a direct shot aimed at his head from less than 4 feet away. In the tiny confines of the shelter, the effect was devastating. The thick, sulfurous, rotten odor filled the small room, heavy, ugly, and stinking. The corrosive spray that hit his face seared into his lungs and eyes, blinding him. He screamed and threw himself sideways, taking the entire wall off the shelter, screamed and clawed out of the shelter, and fell ran to the shore of the lake. Stumbling and tripping, he scrambled into the water and slammed his head back and forth, trying to wash his eyes, slashing at the water to clear his eyes. 100 funny cartoons he had seen about skunks, cute cartoons about the smell of skunks, cartoons to laugh at and joke about. But when the spray hit, there was nothing funny about it. He was completely blind for almost 2 hours, a lifetime. He thought that he might be permanently blind, or at least impaired, and that would have been the end. As it was, the pain in his eyes lasted for days, bothered him after that for 2 weeks. The smell in the shelter, in his clothes, and in his hair was still there now, almost a month and a half later. And he had nearly smiled. Mistakes. Food had to be protected. While he was in the lake trying to clear his eyes, the skunk went ahead and dug up the rest of the turtle eggs and ate every one. Licked all the shells clean, and couldn't have cared less that Brian was thrashing around in the water like a dying carp. The skunk had found food and was taking it, and Brian was paying for a lesson. Protect food and have a good shelter. Not just a shelter to keep the wind and rain out, but a shelter to protect, a shelter to make him safe. The day after the skunk, he set about making a good place to live. The basic idea had been good. The place for his shelter was right, but he just hadn't gone far enough. He'd been lazy. But now he knew the second most important thing about nature, what drives nature. Food was first, but the work for the food went on and on. Nothing in nature was lazy. He had tried to take a shortcut and paid for it with his turtle eggs, which he had come to like more than chicken eggs from the store. They had been fuller somehow, had more depth to them. he set about improving his shelter by tearing it down. From dead pines up the hill, he brought down heavier logs and fastened several of them across the opening, wedging them at the top and burying the bottoms in the sand. Then he wove long branches in through them to make a truly tight wall, and still not satisfied, he took even thinner branches and wove those into the first weave. When he was at last finished, he could not find a place to put his fist through. It all held together like a very stiff woven basket. He judged the door opening to be the weakest spot, and here he took special time to weave a door of willows in so tight a mesh that no matter how a skunk tried, or porcupine, he thought, looking at the marks in his leg, it could not possibly get through. He had no hinges, but by arranging some cut-off limbs at the top in the right way, he had a method to hook the door in place, and when he was in and the door was hung, he felt relatively safe. A bear, something big, could still get in by tearing at it, but nothing small could bother him, and the weave of the structure still allowed the smoke to filter up through the top and out. All in all, it took him 3 days to make the shelter, stopping to shoot fish and eat as he went, bathing 4 times a day to try and get the smell from the skunk to leave. When his house was done, finally done right, he turned to the constant problem, food. It was all right to hunt and eat or fish and eat, but what happened if he had to go a long time without food? What happened when the berries were gone and he got sick or hurt or thinking of the skunk laid up temporarily? He needed a way to store food, a place to store it, and he needed food to store. Mistakes. He tried to learn from the mistakes. He couldn't bury food again, couldn't leave it in the shelter because something like a bear could get at it right away. It had to be high, somehow high and safe. Above the door to the shelter, up the rock face about 10 feet, was a small ledge that could make a natural storage place, unreachable to animals, except that it was unreachable to him as well. A ladder, of course, he needed a ladder, but he had no way to fashion one, nothing to hold the steps on, and that stopped him until he found a dead pine with many small branches still sticking out. Using his hatchet, he chopped the branches off so they stuck out 4 or 5 inches all up along the log. Then he cut the log off about 10 feet long and dragged it down to his shelter. It was a little heavy, but dry, and he could manage it. And when he propped it up, he found he could climb to the ledge with ease, though the tree did roll from side to side a bit as he climbed. His food shelf, as he thought of it, had been covered with bird manure, and he carefully scraped it clean with sticks. He had never seen birds there, but that was probably because the smoke from his fire went up right across the opening, and they didn't like smoke. Still he had learned, and he took time to weave a snug door for the small opening with green willows, cutting it so it jammed in tightly. And when he finished, he stood back and looked at the rock face, his shelter below, the food shelf above, and allowed a small bit of pride to come. Not bad, he had thought. Not bad for somebody who used to have trouble greasing the bearings on his bicycle. Not bad at all. Mistakes. He had made a good shelter and food shelf, but he had no food except for fish and the last of the berries. And the fish, as good as they still tasted then, were not something he could store. His mother had left some salmon out by mistake one time when they went on an overnight trip to Cape Hesper to visit relatives. And when they got back, the smell filled the whole house. There was no way to store fish. At least, he thought, no way to store them dead. But as he looked at the weave of his structure, a thought came to him and he moved down to the water. He had been putting the waste from the fish back in the water, and the food had attracted hundreds of new ones. I wonder. They seemed to come easily to the food, at least the small ones. He had no trouble now shooting them, and had even speared one with his old fish spear now that he knew to aim low. He could dangle something in his fingers, and they came right up to it. It might be possible, he thought, might just be possible to trap them, make some kind of pond. To his right, at the base of the rock bluff, there were piles of smaller rocks that had fallen from the main chunk, splinters and hunks, from double fist size to some as large as his head. He spent an afternoon carrying rocks to the beach and making what amounted to a large pen for holding live fish, 2 rock arms that stuck out 15 feet into the lake and curved together at the end. Where the arms came together, he left an opening about 2 feet across. Then he sat on the shore and waited. When he had first started dropping the rocks, all the fish had darted away. But his fish trash pile of bones and skin and guts was in the pond area, and the prospect of food brought them back. Soon, under an hour, there were 30 or 40 small fish in the enclosure, and Brian made a gate by weaving small willows together into a fine mesh and closed them in. Fresh fish, he had yelled. I have fresh fish for sale. Storing live fish to eat later had been a major breakthrough, he thought. It wasn't just keeping from starving. It was trying to save ahead. Think ahead. Of course, he didn't know then how sick he would get of fish. The days had folded one into another and mixed, so that after 2 or 3 weeks he only knew time had passed in days because he made a mark for each day in the stone near the door to his shelter. Real time he measured in events. A day was nothing, not a thing to remember. It was just sun coming up, sun going down, some light in the middle. But events were burned into his memory, and so he used them to remember time, to know and to remember what had happened, to keep a mental journal. There had been the day of first meat. That had been a day that had started like the rest, up after the sun, clean the camp, and make sure there's enough wood for another night. But it was a long time of eating fish and looking for berries, and he craved more food, heavier food, deeper food. He craved meat. He thought in the night now of meat, thought of his mother's cooking a roast, or dreamed of turkey, and one night he awakened before he had to put wood on the fire with his mouth making saliva and the taste of pork chops in his mouth. So real, and all a dream, but it left him intent on getting meat. He had been working farther and farther out for wood, sometimes now going nearly a quarter of a mile away from camp for wood, and he saw many small animals. Squirrels were everywhere, small red ones that chattered at him and seemed to swear and jumped from limb to limb. There were also many rabbits, large gray ones with a mix of reddish fur, smaller, fast gray ones that he saw only at dawn. The larger ones sometimes sat until he was quite close, then bounded and jerked 2 or 3 steps before freezing again. He thought if he worked at it in practice, he might hit one of the larger rabbits with an arrow or a spear. Never the small ones or the squirrels. They were too small and fast. Then there were the fool birds. They exasperated him to the point where they were close to driving him insane. The birds were everywhere, 5 and 6 in a flock, and their camouflage was so perfect that it was possible for Brian to sit and rest, leaning against a tree with one of them standing right in front of him in a willow clump, 2 feet away, hidden, only to explode into deafening flight just when Brian least expected it. He just couldn't see them, couldn't figure out how to locate them before they flew, because they stood so perfectly still and blended in so perfectly well. And what made it worse was that they were so dumb, or seemed to be so dumb, that it was almost insulting the way they kept hidden from him. Nor could he get used to the way they exploded up when they flew. It seemed like every time he went for wood, which was every morning, he spent the whole time jumping and jerking in fright as he walked. On one memorable morning, he had actually reached for a piece of wood, what he thought to be a pitchy stump at the base of a dead birch, his fingers close to touching it, only to have it blow up in his face. But on the day of first meat, he had decided the best thing to try for would be a fool bird, and that morning he had set out with his bow and spear to get one, to stay with it until he got one and ate some meat. Not to get wood, not to find berries, but to get a bird and eat some meat. At first the hunt had not gone well. He saw plenty of birds working up along the shore of the lake to the end, then down the other side, but he only saw them after they flew. He had to find a way to see them first, see them and get close enough to either shoot them with the bow or use the spear, and he could not find a way to see them. When he had gone halfway around the lake and had jumped up 20 or so birds, he finally gave up and sat at the base of a tree. He had to work this out, see what he was doing wrong. There were birds there, and he had eyes. He just had to bring the two things together. Looking wrong, he thought. I am looking wrong. More than that. I'm being wrong somehow. I'm doing it the wrong way. Fine. Sarcasm came into his thoughts. I know that. Thank you. I know I'm doing it wrong. But what is right? The morning sun had cooked him until it seemed his brain was frying. Sitting by the tree, but nothing came until he got up and started to walk again, and hadn't gone 2 steps when a bird got up. It had been there all the time, while he was thinking about how to see them, right next to him, right there. He almost screamed. But this time, when the bird flew, something caught his eye, and it was the secret key. The bird cut down toward the lake, then, seeing it couldn't land in the water, turned and flew back up the hill into the trees. When it turned, curving through the trees, the sun had caught it, and Brian for an instant saw it as a shape, sharp-pointed in front, back from the head in a streamlined bullet shape to the fat body. Kind of like a pear, he had thought, with a point on one end and a fat little body. A flying pear. And that had been the secret. He had been looking for feathers, for the color of the bird, for a bird sitting there. He had to look for the outline instead, had to see the shape instead of the feathers or color, had to train his eyes to see the shape. It was like turning on a television. Suddenly he could see things he never saw before. In just moments, it seemed, he saw three birds before they flew, saw them sitting, and got close to one of them, moving slowly, got close enough to try a shot with his bow. He had missed that time, and had missed many more, but he saw them. He saw the little fat shapes with the pointed head sitting in the brush all over the place. Time and again he drew, held, and let arrows fly, but he still had no feathers on the arrows, and they were little more than sticks that flopped out of the bow, sometimes going sideways. Even when a bird was 7 or 8 feet away, the arrow would turn without feathers to stabilize it and hit brush or a twig. After a time, he gave up with the bow. It had worked all right for the fish when they came right to the end of the arrow, but it wasn't good for any kind of distance, at least not the way it was now. But he had carried his fish spear, the original one with the two prongs, and he moved the bow to his left hand and carried the spear in his right. He tried throwing the spear, but he was not good enough and not fast enough. The birds could fly amazingly fast, get up fast. But in the end, he found that if he saw the bird sitting and moved sideways toward it, not directly toward it, but at an angle, back and forth, he could get close enough to put the spear point out ahead almost to the bird and thrust lunge with it. He came close twice, and then, down along the lake, not far from the beaver house, he got his first meat. The bird had sat and he had lunged, and the two points took the bird back down into the ground and killed it almost instantly. It had fluttered a bit, and Brian had grabbed it and held it in both hands until he was sure it was dead. Then he picked up the spear and the bow and trotted back around the lake to his shelter, where the fire had burned down to glowing coals. He sat looking at the bird, wondering what to do. With the fish, he had just cooked them whole, left everything in and picked the meat off. This was different. He would have to clean it. It had always been so simple at home. He'd go to the store and get a chicken, and it was all cleaned and neat, no feathers or insides, and his mother would bake it in the oven, and he would eat it. His mother, from the old time, from the time before, would bake it. Now he had the bird, but he had never cleaned one, never taken the insides out or gotten rid of the feathers, and he didn't know where to start. But he wanted the meat, had to have the meat, and that drove him. In the end, the feathers came off easily. He tried to pluck them out, but the skin was so fragile that it pulled off as well, so he just pulled the skin off the bird, like peeling an orange, he thought, sort of, except that when the skin was gone, the insides fell out the back end. He was immediately caught in a cloud of raw odor, a kind of steamy dung odor that came up from the greasy coil of insides that fell from the bird, and he nearly threw up. But there was something else to the smell as well, some kind of richness that went with his hunger and that overcame the sick smell. He quickly cut the neck with his hatchet, cut the feet off the same way, and in his hand he held something like a small chicken, with a dark, fat, thick breast and small legs. He set it up on some sticks on the shelter wall and took the feathers and insides down to the water, to his fish pond. The fish would eat them, or eat what they could, and the feeding action would bring more fish. On second thought, he took out the wing and tail feathers, which were stiff and long and pretty, banded and speckled in browns and grays and light reds. There might be some use for them, he thought. Maybe work them onto the arrows somehow. The rest he threw in the water, saw the small round fish begin tearing at it, and washed his hands. Back at the shelter, the flies were on the meat, and he brushed them off. It was amazing how fast they came. But when he built up the fire and the smoke increased, the flies almost magically disappeared. He pushed a pointed stick through the bird and held it over the fire. The fire was too hot. The flames hit the fat and the bird almost ignited. He held it higher, but the heat was worse, and finally he moved it to the side a bit, and there it seemed to cook properly. Except that it only cooked on one side and all the juice dripped off. He had to rotate it slowly, and that was hard to do with his hands, so he found a forked stick and stuck it in the sand to put his cooking stick in. He turned it. And in this way he found a proper method to cook the bird. In minutes, the outside was cooked, and the odor that came up was almost the same as the odor when his mother baked chickens in the oven, and he didn't think he could stand it. But when he tried to pull a piece of the breast meat off, the meat was still raw inside. Patience, he thought. So much of this was patience, waiting and thinking and doing things right. So much of all this, so much of all living was patience and thinking. He settled back, turning the bird slowly, letting the juices go back into the meat, letting it cook and smell and cook, and there came a time when it didn't matter if the meat was done or not. It was black on the outside and hard and hot, and he would eat it. He tore a piece from the breast, a sliver of meat, and put it in his mouth and chewed carefully, chewed as slowly and carefully as he could to get all the taste, and he thought, never. Never in all the food, all the hamburgers and malts, all the fries or meals at home, never in all the candy or pies or cakes, never in all the roasts or steaks or pizzas, never in all the submarine sandwiches, never, never, never had he tasted anything as fine as that first bite. First meat. And now he stood at the end of the long part of the lake and was not the same. Would not be the same again. There had been many first days. First arrow day, when he had used thread from his tattered old piece of windbreaker and some pitch from a stump to put slivers of feather on a dry willow shaft and make an arrow that would fly correctly. Not accurately. He never got really good with it, but fly correctly, so that if a rabbit or a fool bird sat in one place long enough, close enough, and he had enough arrows, he could hit it. That brought first rabbit day, when he killed one of the large rabbits with an arrow and skinned it as he had the first bird, cooked it the same to find the meat as good, not as rich as the bird, but still good, and there were strips of fat on the back of the rabbit that cooked into the meat to make it richer. Now he went back and forth between rabbits and fool birds when he could, filling in with fish in the middle, always hungry. I'm always hungry, but I can do it now. I can get food, and I know I can get food, and it makes me more. I know what I can do. He moved closer to the lake to a stand of nut brush. These were thick bushes with little stickler pods that held green nuts, nuts that he thought he might be able to eat, but they weren't ripe yet. He was out for a fool bird, and they liked to hide in the base of the thick part of the nut brush, back in where the stems were close together and provided cover. In the second clump he saw a bird, moved close to it, paused when the head feathers came up and it made a sound like a cricket, a sign of alarm just before it flew, then moved closer when the feathers went down and the bird relaxed. He did this four times, never looking at the bird directly, moving toward it at an angle so that it seemed he was moving off to the side. He had perfected this method after many attempts, and it worked so well that he had actually caught one with his bare hands, until he was standing less than 3 feet from the bird, which was frozen in a hiding attitude in the brush. The bird held for him, and he put an arrow to the bow, one of the feathered arrows, not a fish arrow, and drew and released. It was a clean miss, and he took another arrow out of the cloth pouch at his belt, which he'd made from a piece of his windbreaker sleeve, tied at one end to make a bottom. The fool bird sat still for him, and he did not look directly at it until he drew the second arrow and aimed and released and missed again. This time the bird jerked a bit, and the arrow stuck next to it so close it almost brushed its breast. Brian only had 2 more arrows, and he debated moving slowly to change the spear over to his right hand and use that to kill the bird. 1 more shot, he decided. He would try it again. He slowly brought another arrow out, put it on the string, and aimed and released, and this time saw the flurry of feathers that meant he had made a hit. The bird had been struck off-center and was flopping around wildly. Brian jumped on it and grabbed it and slammed it against the ground once, sharply, to kill it. Then he stood and retrieved his arrows and made sure they were all right and went down to the lake to wash the blood off his hands. He kneeled at the water's edge and put the dead bird and his weapons down and dipped his hands into the water. It was very nearly the last act of his life. Later he would not know why he started to turn, some smell or sound, a tiny brushing sound, but something caught his ear or nose, and he began to turn and had his head half around when he saw a brown wall of fur detach itself from the forest to his rear and come down on him like a runaway truck. He just had time to see that it was a moose, He knew them from pictures, but did not know, could not guess, how large they were when it hit him. It was a cow, and she had no horns, but she took him in the left side of the back with her forehead, took him and threw him out into the water, and then came after him to finish the job. He had another half-second to fill his lungs with air, and she was on him again, using her head to drive him down into the mud of the bottom. Insane, he thought. Just that, the word insane. Mud filled his eyes, his ears, the horn boss on the moose drove him deeper and deeper into the bottom muck, and suddenly it was over, and he felt alone. He sputtered to the surface, sucking air and fighting panic, and when he wiped the mud and water out of his eyes and cleared them, he saw the cow standing sideways to him, not 10 feet away, calmly chewing on a lily pad root. She didn't appear to even see him, or didn't seem to care about him, and Brian turned carefully and began to swim, crawl out of the water. As soon as he moved, the hair on her back went up, and she charged him again, using her head and front hooves this time, slamming him back and down into the water on his back this time, and he screamed the air out of his lungs and hammered on her head with his fists and filled his throat with water, and she left again. Once more he came to the surface, but he was hurt now, hurt inside, hurt in his ribs, and he stayed hunched over, pretended to be dead. She was standing again, eating. Brian studied her out of one eye, looking to the bank with the other, wondering how seriously he was injured, wondering if she would let him go this time. Insane. He started to move ever so slowly. Her head turned and her back hair went up like the hair on an angry dog. And he stopped, took a slow breath. The hair went down and she ate. Move, hair up, stop, hair down. Move, hair up. A half foot at a time until he was at the edge of the water. He stayed on his hands and knees, indeed was hurt so he wasn't sure he could walk anyway, and she seemed to accept that and let him crawl slowly out of the water and up into the trees and brush. When he was behind a tree, he stood carefully and took stock. Legs seemed all right, but his ribs were hurt bad. He could only take short breaths, and then he had a jabbing pain, and his right shoulder seemed to be wrenched somehow. Also, his bow and spear and foolbird were in the water. At least he could walk, and he had just about decided to leave everything when the cow moved out of the deeper water and left him as quickly as she'd come, walking down along the shoreline in the shallow water, with her long legs making sucking sounds when she pulled them free of the mud. Hanging on a pine limb, he watched her go, half expecting her to turn and come back to run over him again. But she kept going. And when she was well gone from sight, he went to the bank and found the bird, then waded out a bit to get his bow and spear. Neither of them were broken, and the arrows, incredibly, were still on his belt in the pouch, although messed up with mud and water. It took him most of an hour to work his way back around the lake. His legs worked well enough, but if he took 2 or 3 fast steps, he would begin to breathe deeply, and the pain from his ribs would stop him, and he would have to lean against a tree until he could slow back down to shallow breathing. She had done more damage than he had originally thought, the insane cow. No sense at all to it, just madness. When he got to the shelter, he crawled inside and was grateful that the coals were still glowing, and that he had thought to get wood first thing in the mornings to be ready for the day. Grateful that he had thought to get enough wood for 2 or 3 days at a time. Grateful that he had fish nearby if he needed to eat. Grateful, finally, as he dozed off, that he was alive. So insane, he thought, letting sleep cover the pain in his chest. Such an insane attack for no reason, and he fell asleep with his mind, trying to make the moose have reason. The noise awakened him. It was a low sound, a low roaring sound that came from wind. His eyes snapped open, not because it was loud, but because it was new. He had felt wind in his shelter, felt the rain that came with wind, and had heard thunder many times in the past 47 days, but not this, not this noise. Low, almost alive, almost from a throat somehow, the sound, the noise was a roar, a far-off roar, but coming at him, and when he was fully awake, he sat up in the darkness, grimacing with pain from his ribs. The pain was different now, a tightened pain, and it seemed less, but the sound. So strange, he thought, a mystery sound, a spirit sound, a bad sound. He took some small wood and got the fire going again, felt some little comfort and cheer from the flames, but also felt that he should get ready. He did not know how, but he should get ready. The sound was coming for him, was coming just for him, and he had to get ready. The sound wanted him. He found the spear and bow where they were hanging on the pegs of the shelter wall and brought his weapons to the bed he had made of pine boughs. More comfort, but like the comfort of the flames, it didn't work with this new threat that he didn't understand yet. Restless threat, he thought, and stood out of the shelter away from the flames to study the sky, but it was too dark. The sound meant something to him, something from his memory, something he had read about, something he had seen on television, something... Oh, he thought. Oh, no. It was wind, wind like the sound of a train, with the low belly roar of a train. It was a tornado. That was it. The roar of a train meant bad wind, and it was coming for him. God, he thought, on top of the moose, not this, not this. But it was too late to do anything. In the strange stillness, he looked to the night sky, then turned back into his shelter and was leaning over to go through the door opening when it hit. Later he would think of it and find that it was the same as the moose, just insanity. He was taken in the back by some mad force and driven into the shelter on his face, slammed down into the pine branches of his bed. At the same time, the wind tore at the fire and sprayed red coals and sparks in a cloud around him. Then it backed out, seemed to hesitate momentarily, and returned with a massive roar, a roar that took his ears and mind and body. He was whipped against the front wall of the shelter like a rag, felt a ripping pain in his ribs again, then was hammered back down into the sand once more while the wind took the whole wall, his bed, the fire, his tools, all of it, and threw it out into the lake, gone, out of sight, gone forever. He felt the burning on his neck and reached up to find red coals there. He brushed those off, found more in his pants, brushed those away, and the wind hit again, heavy gusts, tearing gusts. He heard trees snapping in the forest around the rock, felt his body slipping out and clawed at the rocks to hold himself down. He couldn't think, just held and knew that he was praying, but didn't know what the prayer was, knew that he wanted to be, stay and be, and then the wind moved to the lake. Brian heard the great, roaring, sucking sounds of water and opened his eyes to see the lake torn by the wind, the water slamming in great waves that went in all ways, fought each other, and then rose in a spout of water, going up into the night sky like a wet column of light. It was beautiful and terrible at the same time. The tornado tore one more time at the shore on the opposite side of the lake. Brian could hear trees being ripped down, and then it was done, gone as rapidly as it had come. It left nothing. Nothing but Brian in the pitch dark. He could find nothing of where his fire had been, not a spark. Nothing of his shelter, tools, or bed, even the body of the fool bird was gone. I'm back to nothing, he thought, trying to find things in the dark. Back to where I was when I crashed, hurt, in the dark, just the same. As if to emphasize his thoughts, the mosquitoes with the fire gone and protective smoke no longer saving him came back in thick, nostril-clogging swarms. All that was left was the hatchet at his belt, still there. But now it began to rain, and in the downpour he would never find anything dry enough to get a fire going. And at last he pulled his battered body back in under the overhang where his bed had been and wrapped his arms around his ribs. Sleep didn't come, couldn't come with the insects ripping at him, so he lay the rest of the night, slapping mosquitoes and chewing with his mind on the day. This morning he had been fat, well, almost fat, and happy, sure of everything, with good weapons and food and the sun in his face and things looking good for the future. And inside of one day, just one day, he had been run over by a moose and a tornado, had lost everything and was back to square one, just like that. A flip of some giant coin, and he was the loser. But there's a difference now, he thought. There really is a difference. I might be hit, but I'm not done. When the light comes, I'll start to rebuild. I still have the hatchet, and that's all I had in the first place. Come on, he thought, baring his teeth in the darkness. Come on, is that the best you can do? Is that all you can hit me with, a moose and a tornado? Well, he thought, holding his ribs and smiling, and then spitting mosquitoes out of his mouth. Well, that won't get the job done. That was the difference now. He had changed, and he was tough. I'm tough where it counts. Tough in the head. In the end, right before dawn, a kind of cold snap came down. Something else new, this cold snap. and the mosquitoes settled back into the damp grass and under the leaves, and he could sleep or doze. And the last thought he had that morning as he closed his eyes was, "I hope the tornado hit the moose."